Hi, I'm Frances Anderton and this is DNA. We're going to talk about how art and artifacts illustrate a story of cross-cultural pollination.
It is not American culture, it is not Mexican culture, it goes back and forth. People are influenced by each other's culture, people build on each other's culture, people appropriate each other's culture all the time, and that's what you see going on here.
Pacific Standard Time, LALA, officially launches this week, and we're going to hear about Found in Translation. We're also going to talk about the hottest parlor game that's going on right now in urban circles. Who will be the bride of Amazon? First up, though, this morning at Apple's new corporate campus, CEO Tim Cook made some announcements. The reinvention of their retail stores, transforming them into town squares. Also, the new iPhone X and a big change to the iWatch.
Introducing Apple Watch Series 3, and it has cellular built in.
That's Jeff Williams, Apple's COO.
Now you can go for a run with just your watch and still be connected.
He then called a colleague.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Deidre. Hey, I'm calling you from the new Steve Jobs Theater. How are you doing?
I'm a little sad to be missing the keynote, but I'm working very hard out here.
And then up popped a video of Deidre perched on a paddleboard in the middle of a lake. It was all very cute, but the vision of her talking to her watch in the middle of a lake did strike rather a strange tone on a day in which millions of people in Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and the Caribbean are actually engulfed by floodwaters, and many of them can't even make a phone call.
It may not be long before most of us start getting electricity envy. Irma's winds packed a punch that left millions in the dark across central Florida and down south.
This is going to be a long process. It could take up to a week or even more to restore power to everyone in this region.
An NPR reporter with member station WLRN, Nancy Klinger, said that in Key West, quote, it's like we've been transported to the pre-digital, pre-cell phone era. In fact, it's the pre-telephone era for most of us. And our own colleague Rachel Reynolds, producer of Morning Becomes Eclectic, has been struggling to reach her mother in Miami.
It's absolutely been terrifying, to be honest. I had talked to my mom on Saturday night. She was in great spirits, ready to hunker down, ready for whatever comes next. They knew they were going to lose power. But what I didn't realize was that the landline would go out.
So the landline went out, but you couldn't reach her on a cell phone either?
No, I couldn't. And then I got a very curt text from my mom at 10 a.m. and then radio silence. So almost 24 hours.
So you finally heard from your mom yesterday, that is Monday morning. But your mother was not able to connect via the cell phone, except sort of intermittently. Is that right?
That's right.
And to your knowledge, was it lack of cell phone connection, as in a cell phone tower's down, or was it lack of power? Had they run out of juice?
They hadn't run out of juice. So they actually have been powering up their phones in their car. My mom called me yesterday and she was sitting in her car. And I'm hoping we're going to have more regular communication from this point forward, but I don't know for sure.
So Rachel's is just one of many stories like this. Lots and lots of people that we're hearing from who can't reach their loved ones in Miami, other parts of Florida, parts of the Caribbean. And it does beg the question, you know, our lives are becoming increasingly digital. We are absolutely welded to our cell phones. But what happens when all of a sudden we run out of juice? We decided to talk about this with Maggie Reardon. She covers the cell phone industry for CNET.
The biggest thing, particularly during a hurricane, is one, is the equipment able to withstand the wind? And a lot of times that's not the big issue. You know, the infrastructure usually can withstand that. What the problem becomes is the power. And without commercial power, then these cell towers and all the equipment in the switching stations, they need some kind of power. And so a lot of the carriers now have battery backup. That's something that's changed since Katrina. But then there are other things that can go wrong. Like, for example, if something happens to the infrastructure in the ground. So flooding can damage this, where, you know, you have actual lines that are connecting the cell towers to other switching stations and then sort of sending it out into the network. And if something happens there, and that can often be something that knocks out, you know, your landline phone or, 911 service, that hardened infrastructure. And so if something happens to that, that's also a problem. But again, I think the carriers, you know, they have been trying to make their networks more resilient and trying to have sort of a distributed kind of system where if towers go down or if something is failing in one area, the network kind of switches over to another part of the network. But it doesn't always work.
Yeah, you reported that Katrina knocked out more than 1,000 cellular sites. You then said things were improved by the time Sandy hit the eastern U.S. During that storm, 400 cell towers were knocked out. You talked in your reporting to representatives of the wireless carriers who told you they're working to make sure the customers stay connected during after the storm. But you also talked to a consumer advocate who said it's not enough for these operators to simply say they're prepared. She wants the FCC to make battery and generator a backup to cell sites a requirement. And now we have Chuck Schumer calling for, I guess, legislation to enforce that. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the FCC had proposed that as part of their evaluation after Katrina, you know, that they wanted carriers to be mandated to have backup power, and they made that a rule, and then it never was put into effect because the carriers ended up suing. But I think the question becomes, does it become a mandate? And, you know, we'll have to see if Congress is able to push something through.
But the takeaway ultimately is that we are in an increasingly connected world, and something like a massive weather event can kind of knock our confidence in that reality.
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that people do become very dependent on. What it comes down to is our power grid. And that is absolutely crucial for all of this stuff to work during these crises is, you know, we need power.
You just heard from Maggie Reardon. She's senior reporter for CNET. I'm Frances Anderton, and you're listening to DNA. We've just been talking about power and cell phones. Well, now one of the world's largest tech companies has the power to transform the fortunes of a North American city.
Amazon's second headquarters announcement has sparked a major bidding war among top cities in the U.S. and Canada.
Times, Jeff Bezos and company are looking to drop something like $5 billion on a second HQ that Bezos says will be a full equal to their current campus in Seattle.
And they're also asking for more incentives to sweeten the deal. They want tax credits and exemptions, workforce and relocation grants. Amazon will consider any city who meets the criteria, but of course, it's all about the bottom line.
So which city might win Amazon's hand? Urbanists and reporters all over the country have been speculating, and one of those is Patrick Sisson. He's a senior reporter at Curbed, which ran its own column on which cities are in contention. He joins us from New York, and he has written that this is the $5 billion Super Bowl of economic development.
Basically, it's because cities are getting what they've been trying to get and doing anything they can do to get for the last 10, 15, 20 years, getting a huge amount of high-paid, skilled tech employees in the middle of their city. Amazon's promised that this will be sort of a second headquarters, you know, equal in scope and sort of importance to their one in Seattle, which means about 50,000 people, which is a huge deal.
And a lot of people, urbanists, reporters, have already started speculating with great authority as to which city Amazon is going to pick. Does anyone actually know what Amazon's thinking is right now?
I mean, that's certainly up for question. Amazon put out an RFP to cities. They have until October to put in their sort of bid for this project. And a lot of people have done really great analyses. I would say one of the best that people have been talking a lot about is Emily Badger's piece in the New York Times that sort of breaks down based on Amazon's criteria.
Now, Emily Badger's piece concludes with one city that she and her co-authors are very sure that the city is going to be Denver. You guys at Curbed also came up with a list of cities that might win. You didn't even include Denver. So what's going on here?
Well, we were looking at a lot of cities that, you know, we were familiar with, that we had the sort of Curbed editors there. So that's one of the reasons we didn't include Denver. I wouldn't say that we are as exhaustive as a lot of other people have done in terms of sort of breaking down the numbers. I think Denver is definitely, again, that's been one of the top five in sort of countless different sort of analyses and ideas. The other ones I've heard quite a bit of: Austin, Chicago, Boston, Charlotte. Toronto has been named quite a few times. There's a lot of cities that have really great tech industries and a lot of like tech talent. That's one of the big things Amazon is looking for. There's cities that have a lot of room. That's another thing Amazon's looking for. This is expected to be a massive headquarters equivalent to the 33 buildings they have in Seattle. A lot of them have really great transportation networks. Amazon has been very clear that they're looking for something that is connected to mass transit. They're also different mixes of sort of cost of living and quality of life. I think that's one of the things that, however, is sort of unfortunately not favoring some of the cities such as New York City, Los Angeles, a lot of coastal cities where real estate is really expensive, housing is really expensive. It does, you know, present kind of an obstacle when you're looking to bring or recruit 50,000 new people.
You mentioned the unaffordable housing in relation to coastal cities. There's also another coastal cities issue, which we most certainly have seen over the last few days, and that's the risks of being on the coasts. I've certainly seen speculation that one of the reasons Jeff Bezos won't pick a coastal city is because he himself believes in climate change and thinks that would be a risky pick. You left the coastal cities that have been subject to hurricanes off of your list.
Yeah, and I think that another thing, at the time, it seems like there's a lot of coastal cities like Miami and Houston clearly have a lot of things they're going to be thinking about in terms of development over the next couple weeks. So they seem like they might be long shots in some ways. And yeah, I mean, I think that there's been a lot of speculation in terms of climate, both climate change being an issue and also just sort of like a great climate. That's one of the reasons a lot of people, again, have mentioned Denver. Because, you know, it's a place a lot of people love to be. The climate's very favorable. It's something people talk about quite a bit about relocation. So that works on a lot of different ways.
It's been fantastic to follow all the stories and to watch all the comments. I love reading all the comments from all these folks chiming in on why their city's best. But that's the idealistic end of this story. The more cynical end of the story is they're going to go to the city that gives them the best tax breaks.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you've seen with the story, like, for instance, Foxconn and people debating like how much those incentives are actually helping, if they're helping at all. It does become a big part of this debate. And I think a lot of people, Richard Florida was one of them who said that if Amazon really goes fishing for a lot of incentives and sort of tax breaks and things like that, it doesn't necessarily look great for a huge, very successful company to be sort of looking for breaks. In fact, he actually said that it would be great for them if they would just sort of approach this as, let's, you know, really devote this to helping the city. We're not looking for incentives. We're really merely looking for the best place, and we're going to try and really invest in the place we choose as a second home. That alone would be sort of a PR coup for them.
Well, Patrick, it's great to talk to you. Let's just conclude by asking you, in your heart of hearts, which city do you think's going to win?
Well, I have two theories. I know I'm kind of hedging my bets here. One, I'm originally from Chicago, so I'm going to root for them. it sounds like I'm rooting for a sports team, but yeah, all for Chicago. I also think, you know, the fact, one, that they've said so much about it being a North American location, and just because of questions about talent retention, this is a huge talent retention thing for Amazon. I think it would be premature to count out Toronto. I think having a place in another country, a place that doesn't have a lot of the immigration debates and issues that we're having right now in the United States, could be really, really great for a company that has really big ambitions.
That was Patrick Sisson. He's senior reporter at Curbed. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, Mexico, our neighbor to the south, has always influenced California's design and architecture. And it turns out the inspiration flows both ways.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Pacific Standard Time, LALA, officially launches this week. And one of the major shows is at LACMA. It's called Found in Translation, Design in California and Mexico, 1915 to 1985. The show is fascinating. It looks at the cross-pollination in design and architecture between California and Mexico, and it explores why so much of the credit went to Spain and why we put up walls between two countries that have been sampling each other's cultures for so long. Wendy Kaplan co-curated the show, which is on show at the Resnick Pavilion at LACMA. She takes us on a tour, showing us first a poster. And in the poster is a building by the architect Bertram Goodhue.
We are rounding up the usual suspects, but even the usual suspects will be presented in a new light.
Just explain what you mean by the usual suspects.
Well, the usual suspects would be a dreamy evocation of Spanish dons, the hacienda, the noble native, as opposed to the decimation and appropriation of indigenous Mexican culture. So we present the myths, and we hope we dispel the myths, but also discuss the persistence of myth and how that has affected perceptions up until today.
So take us back to the poster that we're looking at and just sort of explain how that is manifest in both the exhibition itself and the poster.
Well, famously, the fair was designed by the architect Bertram Goodhue, a very well-known New York architect who actually had spent a lot of time in Mexico and loved Mexican architecture. Next to it is a beautiful drawing. It's a direct reference to the church in Taxco. What's fascinating is that even though Goodhue fully credited his sources, most people just called that Spanish. And it was something that the Mexicans were upset about.
Co-curator Wendy Kaplan's last big exhibition at LACMA was one called Living in a Modern Way. It was all about California modernism, and it was a big hit. Well, this exhibition shows how lots of major architects and designers of that period were part of this two-way dialogue with Mexico. So modernism is one of the four main periods that's explored in this show, along with Spanish colonial inspiration that we just heard about, pre-Hispanic revivals, and folk art and craft traditions. It's complicated and it's very interesting. Wendy shows us now the section called Pre-Hispanic Revivals. And in this period, Mexican artists drew inspiration, she says, from indigenous art traditions. This is exemplified in an extremely elaborate and intricately carved upright wood piano.
This piano won a gold prize at the Paris World's Fair in 1900. And it's the epitome of the pre-Hispanic revival styles that started well before the Mexican Revolution. This is 1900.
In Mexico. We're talking here.
But as you know, World's Fairs were where countries strutted their stuff and demonstrated they were players. This piano took 5 years to make, and it is not a coincidence that the pre-Hispanic revival style chosen is Zapotec revival, because, surprise, Zapotec civilization was from Oaxaca. The Mexican dictator Porfirio Diaz was from Oaxaca. So it was not only a way to demonstrate Mexican pride, it was a way of sucking up to the government.
Wrapped up in all these artifacts is a story of geopolitical relations between the US and Latin America. And this came to the fore in the 1930s with Franklin D. Roosevelt's Good Neighbor Policy. This policy was intended to overcome hostile feelings towards the US while blocking Soviet influence on its southern neighbors. Back to Wendy Kaplan.
And another great example of this is Walt Disney Studios worked closely with the State Department. They were commissioned to do a series of films promoting Pan-American unity. And here are some beautiful drawings from
the grain that built a hemisphere to show we're just one happy hemisphere all together with our reliance on corn.
There's something very timely about this exhibition now, Wendy, given what's going on.
We didn't expect it, and obviously we're not happy about it in terms of, I would prefer this be less relevant, but we are very happy about being able to make the statement about how interconnected and interdependent our cultures are. And so much of our heritage is because of the dialogues, exchanges, and actually the people of Mexico, not just the interactions with Mexican culture.
So in the section of the exhibit that is devoted to the pre-Hispanic revival, you'll also find a period beginning in the 1960s when the Chicano movement in the US adapted iconography from Mesoamerican civilizations, particularly the Aztecs, in order to reclaim a sense of national identity. Co-curator Stacey Steinberger brings us to one very significant poster.
So what we're looking at here is a poster by the Chicana artist Yolanda Lopez. And what you see is this very powerful rendition of an Aztec warrior taking on that same stance of Uncle Sam in the famous I Want You for the United States Army poster. And what it says is, who's the illegal alien pilgrim? And what she's doing here is questioning that dominant narrative of American history of who belongs here and who doesn't, something that you could say is very relevant. And this poster has remained incredibly relevant. She originally designed it in 1978. And it was printed widely in 1981 and continues to inspire activists. It's continually reprinted and referenced to this day.
Your journey finishes in 1985, and 1984, we have the LA Olympics. Talk about why they're in this exhibit.
We're actually looking at the 1984 Olympics in dialogue with the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. And one thing we really emphasize in our section on modernism is that you have Los Angeles and Mexico City as these two huge sprawling metropolises that really build up in the post-war period. And so when you look at the Olympics in both cities, they really had to grapple with how do you bring people into these large cities, and they really did that with design. And both Olympics have become really signatures of Olympic design. In the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, you have this wonderful op art logo by Lance Wyman, a New York designer who was working in Mexico City with under the direction of Mexican architect Pedro Ramirez Vazquez and with Eduardo Terrazas. Now, fast forward to the 1984 Olympics when Sussman Preja, designer Deborah Sussman and Paul Preja, along with
John Jardy.
With their team of designers. And what they did here was create this kit of parts.
And they had a palette of colors, turquoise and orange and pink and purple and stripes.
I mean, one of the things that we see popping up again and again is that Mexico really serves as an inspiration for color. I know with Deborah Sussman, she traveled to Mexico. She was really creating a palette that she saw as representative of Los Angeles as the gateway to the Pacific Rim. And so we really see that connection through color.
Wendy, I do want to ask you, as a design historian, did you, in investigating this story, were you surprised? Did you learn something that made you reflect on the way you had been taught design history?
Absolutely, because the story of Mexico has just not been front and center. And I am embarrassed that I thought I knew the Spanish colonial revival, because of the four themes, that's the one that's most still around us. All our great public buildings, from Union Station to Beverly Hills
City Hall.
And I thought I knew it. And I just, if you dig just a little deeper, it seems commonsensical that more of the direct inspiration would come from Mexico. But I hadn't been aware of how deeply Mexican culture permeates California design.
That was Wendy Kaplan. Now, one of the intriguing sidebars in this show is a look at a style called Colonial Californiano.
This is a style that really intrigued LA Times arts writer Carolina Miranda, and she joined us at the installation to tell us about it.
It's the most bizarre sequence of architectural influences ever. It's a Mexican adaptation of the Spanish Revival architecture that was happening in Los Angeles in the 1920s. What is Spanish Revival architecture? It's an adaptation of Mexican colonial architecture called Spanish because it sounded nicer. So it's this kind of cultural hall of mirrors. And at the time that these buildings were being built, in the 1930s and the 1940s, Mexico was in full swing modernism. Barragán was building some of his most experimental homes. Other architects were experimenting with modernism. And here come these architects to do these colonial-inspired structures. And they were considered shopping centers, houses, often for the nouveau riche. In the case of Mexico, it's the nuevos ricos. It's the people with money who wanted to show their Mexican identity, weren't ready to go with modernism. So they went with this kind of pastiche of colonialism in neighborhoods like Polanco in Mexico City. And I happened to be in Mexico City earlier this year and toured a number of the buildings, including one for which there are sketches in the show.
And how are the buildings now? Are they beloved?
You know, the buildings, I think, are just beginning to get attention by architectural historians. You know, one of the things that set this style apart from the Mexican colonial style is Mexican colonial style usually went to the edge of the property and it had a patio in the interior. Any outdoor space was in the interior. This style was about having the garden surrounding it in the style of an American suburban home. And so a lot of these, as a result, lend themselves to great restaurants because you have this exterior area where you can have a patio and people can eat. So a lot of them in the Polanco area have been converted to bars and restaurants. The interesting story that this particular type of architecture tells is that culture is not this cut and dry thing. It is not American culture. It is not Mexican culture. It goes back and forth. People are influenced by each other's culture. People build on each other's culture. People appropriate each other's culture all the time. And that's what you see going on here.
So in this exhibition, we are seeing all these architectural typologies, and they relate to Spain and they relate to Mexico. And there are words like Spanish colonial and colonial californiano. But there is actually a word that's not on the walls here. And it and it's a word that most of us cannot actually pronounce. But there's a lot of it in LA. Can you say that word and explain it?
Yes. The word in English is churigueresque. And in Spanish, it's churigueresco. It comes from the Spanish. It was this very popular Baroque architectural style that was all about the super duper ornate. It was like more is more. Pile on the carvings, pile on the lintels with all kinds of decor, the carved columns. Like it, if you look at a church whose entire facade is just covered in trimmings, that is likely churigueresque. And it was very popular in Mexico. It was very popular in Peru. And by default, it has ended up on buildings here in Los Angeles.
And there are examples in this exhibition, but they don't refer to it by that name. Because I think they were worried they'd be asked about it and then they'd have to say the word.
Well, I think it's time for LACMA to say churigueresco and to maybe have a cocktail named after it at Ray's Bar.
Carolina Miranda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Carolina Miranda. She's arts writer for the Los Angeles Times. Found in translation, Design in California and Mexico, 1915 to 1985, opens at LACMA this coming Sunday. It is part of Pacific Standard Time, LALA. You can see images of the show at kcrw.com/DNA blog and find out more about all the other shows. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.